William Carey, the pioneering missionary, seems to be an unlikely candidate for discouragement. He was known as the father of modern missions, and yet we have discovered, written within the pages of his diary, these somewhat surprising words. He writes on one occasion, "I am defective in all my duties. In prayer I wander. I am too formal. I soon tire out. Devotion languishes. I do not walk with God." Imagine those surprising words from a saint. The truth is, even the best can become downhearted and depressed. If I asked you to choose a character in the Bible that experienced great despair, I don't think many of us would choose Elijah right off the bat. He is the prophet of fire and miracles. He is the amazing prophet of God. If I asked you to choose one chapter out of the Bible where we are given guidelines on how to overcome discouragement, I doubt we would choose 1 Kings chapter 19. But that's where we are this morning, and you'll find some rather interesting discoveries with me. So would you take your Bibles and turn to 1 Kings chapter 19. By the way, I happen to believe, as a student of not only our culture but of history, that there have always been the ingredients that produce great stress upon the human heart and life. I want to read you something that I pulled from an editorial. It said this: "The world is too big for us. Too much is going on. Too many crimes. Too much violence and excitement. Try as you will get behind in the race in spite of yourself. It's an incessant strain to keep pace, and still you lose ground. Science empties its discoveries on you so fast that you stagger beneath them in hopeless bewilderment. The political world is news seen so rapidly, you're out of breath trying to keep pace with who's in and who's out. Everything is high pressure. Human nature can't endure much more." So reads the editorial in the Atlantic Journal, June 16th, 1833. In chapter 18, as we observe the patient before he experiences divine therapy and encouragement, we'll call it, has gone through some rather incredible times. You remember the story, if you were with us last Lord's Day, that we studied this man. Elijah has stood on Mount Carmel and he has prayed a very brief, short prayer, and fire from heaven has fallen. Let's go back to that prayer, verse 37 of chapter 18. Refreshing our memories by reading, "Answer me, O Lord, answer me that this people may know that thou, O Lord, art God, and that thou hast turned their heart back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, 'The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God.'" Can you imagine being Elijah at this moment? Wouldn't that be exciting? He's been praying for years that revival will come, that Baal will be overthrown. This has got to be, in his diary, the most exciting victory in his spiritual experience. This is one you'd write home about. "Oh, Lord, it's wonderful to be your prophet. Sign me up for a few more years." Notice verse 41. It really just gets a little better. Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink, for there is the sound of the roar of a heavy shower." There is? Where? I didn't hear anything. There's not a cloud in the sky. It hasn't rained for 3.5 years. I wouldn't be surprised if Elijah hadn't forgotten what the sound of rain was like. But he says here, "I hear the sound of the roar of a heavy shower." He's hearing through the ears of faith. The ears of faith never depend upon outward circumstances. They solely depend upon the word from God. Go back in chapter 18 to verse 1 and notice the word that produced the ears of faith. "Now it came about after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, 'Go, show yourself to Ahab, and what? And I will send rain on the face of the earth.' So based upon that word, he can already hear it. Where most Christians would be saying, if we lived back then, I'll believe it when I see it. No, Elijah's reaching for the umbrella. He's taking God at his word. Faith is the evidence of things not seen. Were we more like Elijah? Now notice his actions. He begins to pray rather intensely. Verse 42. So Ahab went up to eat and drink, but Elijah went up to the top of Carmel and he crouched down on the earth. And he put his face between his knees. And after prayer, evidently, he said to his servant, go up now, look toward the sea. That is the Mediterranean that they could see from their perspective on Mount Carmel. So he went up and looked and said, there's nothing. And he said, go back. They did this 7 times. Verse 44. And it came about at the 7th time that he said, behold, a cloud as small as a man's hand is coming up from the sea. And he said, go and say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down so the heavy shower does not stop you. There's a cloud about the size of a nickel. And Elijah's telling Ahab, you better get down before you get stopped by the heavy shower. I love this man's faith. Verse 45. So it came about in a little while that the sky grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy shower. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. Then the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins, and he outran Ahab to Jezreel. Now yet another miracle. Jezreel is approximately 20 miles away. This old prophet runs the whole way in front of the chariot with his camel's hair cloak tucked into his belt. Can you imagine? I think all the way there, God was communicating, among other things, to Ahab, Elijah is my man. Listen to him. Now, as Elijah's running, what do you think he's thinking? Well, I just kicked my feet back on the desk and tried to imagine what this must have been like and what he's reasoning as he ran. He's probably thinking, and we don't know, and I could be dead wrong, but I can't help but believe he's thinking, based on his reaction later, now, from the fact that fire fell from heaven as he's running along, surely Jezebel needs nothing more to prove that Israel's God is the one true God. Surely that great fireball and now the sound of rain and this pouring, drenching downpour will be enough proof to make that woman bow before the one true God. And he's just thinking, I can see Bible studies taking place in the palace. Maybe they'll appoint me chaplain of the king's court. And he's already working on his 3-point sermon for that next day. I just can't imagine. He is so excited at what God has done. Well, back at the palace, the queen has been waiting all day and wondering what's happened to Ahab. Why has it taken so long? But now the downpour. Evidently, when Ahab arrived, she probably met him straight away. Ahab, you're dripping wet. Don't bring that water into the house. He probably had to take his galoshes off right there at the door. Finally getting in, she says, isn't Baal great? The rain, the prophets of Baal must have won. Before she goes too far, he butts in with a reality check. Chapter 19, verse 1. Now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Talk about letting air out of your sails. Verse 2. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, so may the gods do to me, and even more, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. Never mind about fire from heaven, Elijah. Never mind about this downpour coming at your request from your God. Now you're going to answer to me. Now the interesting thing in the text is that she doesn't send her soldiers to immediately arrest and execute him. Why? Not really told. But undoubtedly, had she done that, that wouldn't have been very bright because that would have made a martyr out of Elijah. The people are already rumbling in their excitement of what God has done. So she tries a rather different tactic. A tactic that up to this point in Elijah's life didn't necessarily work very well. This tactic is to somehow scare Elijah into running for his life. If she can get him out of the country, that will diminish his heroic status before the people is the prophet of God, and that will diminish this coming revival as well. So what she does is she tells Elijah, in effect, you have 24 hours to get out of town. If you don't, you're dead. And unfortunately, it worked. I learned something this week. Do you know why a lion roars? Among other things, to paralyze his victims with fear. Peter tells us that the enemy of our soul roams the earth as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may intimidate, devour. By the way, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, a rather ancient translation, adds a phrase to Jezebel's threat to Elijah. She says to him, just as my name is Jezebel and your name is Elijah, I'm going to do this. Which is kind of interesting. She's obviously playing off the meaning of their names. Elijah means Yahweh is God. Izebel or Jezebel means Baal is my prince. Just as you say Yahweh is your God, well, I've got news for you. Baal is my prince. In other words, the battle is not over. It's just round one. This thing's going to continue. Verse 3. And he was afraid and arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. Many believe his servant was the widow's son. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. It grows about 10 feet high, has some spreading branches and some big leaves. And he requested for himself that he might die and said, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take my life. Can you imagine? In the space of only a few hours, Elijah has gone from the victory of Mount Carmel to the Slough of Despond. Now, Lord, it's enough. Take my life. Like the manager of a boxer who's in the ring being killed. The manager knows that his boxer is not ever going to be able to pull out of the fight. So he takes his towel and he throws it into the ring, and that instantly ends the bout and it signals surrender or defeat. Elijah is like that individual who throws his towel into the ring and he says, Lord, I can't pull out of this one. I'm whipped. I quit. Can you hear the pathos in his voice? He is 90 miles from nobody. He's deeper into the wilderness from even his own servant. The last part of verse 4, he says, it's enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I am not better than my father's. That's it, Lord. I've had it. I quit. For the master physician has already told us that he will not test us above that which we are able, but will, with that testing, make a way of escape that you might be able to what? Endure it. Bear it, that he might erase it, that he might take you far from it. But we've misinterpreted that verse in our Christian experience to believe that God's going to make a way of escape. That means I'm out of here and the problems are left behind. Oh, no. He will provide a way of escape. That is, he will give you the grace to endure that testing. The word endure means to bear up under. Peter used the same word when he talked about bearing up under deep sorrow. That's what God will provide. He doesn't inoculate us from sorrow as Christians, but he does promise to be with us in the sorrow. And now notice how he handles Elijah as a master counselor, as a divine physician. He wonderfully handles this discouraged man. Verse 5. And he lay down and slept under a juniper tree. And behold, there was an angel touching him, and he said to him, arise, eat. Then he looked, and behold, there was at his head a bread cake baked on hot stones. Imagine this angelic room service here. And a jar of water. So he ate and drank, and he lay down again. Now notice that God does nothing about his request to die. Furthermore, he doesn't storm up to Elijah and say, Elijah, what's this about quitting? What's this about wanting to die? That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. How can you be so selfish? You think life is hard? You think the world is corrupt? You ought to view it from up here. Aren't you glad that God doesn't answer all our prayers? Think of it. What Elijah would have missed had God answered his prayer. He would have missed being translated to heaven in a whirlwind, riding on a chariot of fire. He would have missed establishing the schools of the prophets, which would graduate more than 100 faithful men for the prophet's ministry. He would have missed a wonderful relationship with a friend he hasn't even met yet by the name of Elisha. Think of what he would have missed had God answered his prayer. He doesn't answer. In fact, all he does is really just give Elijah, this one tired prophet, an opportunity to sleep some of it off. Now, Elijah, the word tells us, was a man just like us. You know what that tells me? That every one of us have gone to God with similar complaints. Lord, it's a little tough. In fact, I've had my limit. I quit. It's as if God has been reading our mail and he includes it in this text. We are just like Elijah. And therefore, what some of you need to do very soon, what some of you may need to do today, is rest. One author said that there are times when the best thing that you can do for your spiritual walk is eat some dinner and hit the sack. Is that good advice? I'm going to do that this afternoon. Nobody calls me. You say, but I've got kids. They're bouncing off the walls. Well, give them a big dose of Benadryl. Check with your physician first. I love the answer that little kid gave when he asked, son, if your mother could have anything in the world, what would she like the most? He shot back immediately. She'd like to go back to bed. Well, when you're totally exhausted like Elijah and you start looking for that juniper tree, you also tend to jump to conclusions. See, Elijah here did. He thought God had lost. Earlier he thought he had won, but now God's lost. And the situation is hopeless. So the Lord allows him protected sleep. But did you notice he also prepares food? It's personally delivered by an angel. Why an angel? Perhaps as a reminder to Elijah that, Elijah, there are a lot of things going on that you can't see. You remember those ears of faith? You could hear things that had yet to fall from heaven. Well, there are things that you can't see that are going on in the heavens. And I happen to think it's amusing, with my warped sense of humor, that Elijah is so wiped out here, he hardly notices the angel. Did you catch that? The angel wakes him up, says, here are these stones that have appeared out of nowhere, and there's a hot cake of bread on it and a jar of water. And he sort of rumbles awake, and he devours the food, and he rolls over and goes back to sleep. He's just had an angel deliver it. He didn't even know it. Notice verse 7. Then the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise, eat, because the journey is too great for you. So he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food, that special angel food, 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now I love what happens next. God, this master counselor, will give Elijah an opportunity to talk. Look at verse 9. Then he came there to a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, what are you doing, Elijah? That's another way of saying, would you tell me how you feel? What brought you to this point? You ever sat at the feet of a counselor and they ask you that question? Well, tell me what brought you here. That's what God's doing with Elijah. Elijah, how'd you get here? As if he didn't know. Tell me what led these events in your life to now you're discouraged under a juniper tree. Tell me how you feel. Boy, does Elijah cut loose here. Verse 10. And he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, torn down thine altars, and killed thy prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Thank you, Elijah, for telling us how you feel. Now God begins spiritual reconstructive surgery on his patient. And the first thing that he's going to do is deal with Elijah's memory. It's failing here. And so with three very powerful displays, he reminds Elijah that he is still sovereign. Would you look with me at verse 11? So he said, "Go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by. And a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord." Most interpret this as a tornado. "But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire." I've learned, as I asked a few questions this past week, that when a person is treated for amnesia, loss of memory, that names and people and places and events and situations are brought up before the patient to help him or her recover their sense of order, to help refresh their memory. These dramatic displays of power are designed to remind Elijah that God is the one who rides the wind, the tornado, not Baal. God is the one who designs the lightning flashes of fire to hit planet Earth, not Baal. God says, "I need to remind you of some things." And I think Elijah got the picture. But now God wants to deepen his understanding of who he is. See, God, did you notice that he chose not to reveal himself in those mighty acts? It keeps saying, "But the Lord was not in that, the Lord was not in that, the Lord was not in that." You see, Elijah had come to the point in his life, and rightly so, where he had come to depend upon these dramatic expressions of God's power to know that in fact God was there. And had he seen them, everything from the resurrection of a dead boy to a meal appearing mysteriously, miraculously in a jar, and oil in a jar, and all of these things taking place that have revealed to him, and including, of course, the great fireball from heaven that completely consumed the altar. Now, God's in that. Elijah, how do you know God's alive? Well, let me tell you about the fire. Let me tell you about raising the dead. God wants to deepen his understanding. He wanted him to learn that he is also there in a very still, small voice. If you look at verse 12, "After the earthquake of fire, after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. And it came about when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah? How do you feel now?'" David Roper has helped explain this point to some degree, and I have found it helpful, and let me read it to you. Interesting. He says, "You never know about God. He may appear in extraordinary ways, in hurricanes and fire, but that's not his typical style. He seems to prefer much less obvious methods. He works in quietness, in silence." I want you to capture this phrase. God's best efforts are rarely seen. The problem with Elijah is that he had unrealistic expectations of God. He expected a repeat performance of Mount Carmel. Well, perhaps God would make short work of Jezebel, blasting her off the face of the earth with a fireball. But instead of a lightning bolt, Jezebel lives, and Elijah has a contract on his life. God's way of correcting Elijah's perspective was to bring him to the place of revelation, that it is in the quiet place where we can hear God's voice as well. Well, now the divine physician, as he operates in this reconstructive surgery, he now seeks to restore Elijah's lost vision. You probably picked up on his limited eyesight. Look at verse 14 again. He says, "And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." Now look at the Lord's gentle rebuke in verse 18. Skip down there. "Elijah, I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him," that is, or his images. In other words, Elijah, you say you're the only one left. Well, your math skills need some serious work. You think you're the only one. No wonder you're discouraged. You think you're the only one working for me. No wonder you're tired. See, Elijah had to learn at this juncture that he was not indispensable. He was not the only one, that God had others. But if you have the impression that you are the only one, no wonder you're tired. and worn out. I love the way this gal wrote it by the name Dorothy Hodgins. She writes, I'm tired. Yes, I'm tired. For several years, I've been blaming it on middle age, iron poor blood, lack of vitamins, air pollution, saccharin, dieting, and a dozen other maladies that make you wonder if life is really worth living. But now I find out it isn't that at all. I've finally figured out why I'm so tired. The population of this country, she writes tongue-in-cheek, is 250 million. 114 million are retired. That leaves 136 million to do the work. There are 95 million in school, which leaves only 41 million. Of this total, there are 22 million employed by the government, and they're not doing anything. That leaves 19 million to do the work. 4 million are in the armed forces, which leaves 15 million to do the work. Take from that total the 14,800,000 people who work for the state and city government, and that leaves 200,000 people to do the work. But there are 188,000 in hospitals, so that leaves 12,000 to do the work. And there are 11,998 people in prison. That leaves just two people to do the work, you and me. And you're just sitting there reading this. No wonder I'm tired, she says. Classic. Well, Elijah had reached the conclusion, Lord, I'm the only one. And may I remind you, Lord, if something happens to me, which I'm praying for, there won't be anybody left. What a pity party. The divine mathematician comes back and he says, let's correct your figures, Elijah. There are 7,000 who haven't bowed to Baal. And I know every one of their names, even though you don't. Have you realized by now in your Christian experience that you are encouraged most by people who suffer in the same way you do? I spent some time this past week in the home of a gal who is suffering with cancer, and her and her husband, through the chemotherapy treatments that are very difficult to go through, and she told me, she said, Stephen, the most encouraging moments I have had have been with other people who have had cancer or who have cancer. Give me a call. Do you know the most skilled counselor could be to help people who've lost a child through some accident? It'll be someone else who's lost a child. Like that dear family I read about this morning in the Cary News, whose truck ran over their little boy. A believing couple who speaks their language. See, that's the kind of counsel that God is giving Elijah right here. He says, Elijah, you're not alone. There are 7,000 people who are enduring blasphemy against my name. There are 7,000 people with character, though persecuted, who have refused to bow their knee to Baal. They won't do it. What an encouragement that must have been to Elijah. I'm not alone. In fact, that's the last thing here that God informs Elijah of before he sends him back into the battle. As the divine physician is patching up this wounded heart, he, with that very still, small voice, whispers to Elijah, you're not alone. There are literally hundreds of people who are going through what you're going through, and you haven't even met any of them yet. But you can't meet any of them under the juniper tree. You can't be helped in a cave. You have to leave. Let's go back to verse 14, and you'll notice that God asks Elijah the second time the same question. Elijah, what are you doing here? How are you feeling, Elijah? Why don't you talk to me? And Elijah repeats himself. It doesn't seem like we've made much progress here. But I want you to understand that while the language is the same, I think the tone is totally different. And the reason for that is based on what follows. Notice the command that God gives Elijah in verse 15. And the Lord said to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you've arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. Now something happened. There are no more miracles, no more displays, no more revelation, a command to go. How could that be? Well, God's message evidently got through. And Elijah's ready for a fresh commission. Let me try to explain it this way. The first time Elijah spoke in verse 10, when God said, Elijah, tell me how you're feeling.
Hang on, we're almost through.
He said the first time, Lord, I have represented you as your prophet to no avail. And they have killed the godly prophets. And the country has gone into idolatry. And now they're trying to take my life. I quit. The second time, Lord, I have represented you as your prophet, but to no avail. They have killed the prophets of God who've also stood for you. The whole country is idolatrous, and now they seek my life. What's next? What do you want me to do now? Therefore, God can tell him in verse 15 to go. See, one of the things Elijah learned is that what God has done is not all that God is going to do. You with me? What God has done doesn't signal that this is all that God is going to do. Lord, I do not understand your plans that have unfolded for me yesterday or today. But I will believe that you have tomorrow to unfold in your sovereign will. In 1809, as you study history, this perspective is rather wonderful. The entire focus of Western civilization was not on Britain. It certainly wasn't on this young America. It was on Austria. And the centerpiece of world news was this little dictator named Napoleon. As he swept through Europe, claiming one nation after another as just one more jewel in his kingdom. He was out to rule the world, and everybody was focused on Napoleon. Surely, what God had planned for the world was going to end with him. And yet in 1809, when Austria fell to Napoleon, when people must have thought the end of the world had come, Gladstone was born in England. That same year, Alfred Tennyson was born. And in this young America, in this rustic log cabin in Hardin County, Kentucky, an illiterate farmer and his wife heard the cries of their newborn son, whom they named Abraham. Abraham Lincoln. If you were a slave in America in 1809, you would have struggled with the fact that what God had done was all that God was going to do. And yet the emancipator of slaves had just been born. God is not bound in what he plans to one day, to one generation, to one nation. And that is the lesson that Elijah is going to learn, and he is in the process of learning. Let me tell you why. Jehu, the man that Elijah was sent to anoint as king, it will be Jehu who eradicates Baalism from Israel after Elijah has died. It is Elisha, this young associate prophet that he hadn't even met yet, it will be Elisha who sees the roots of revival take place in developing this turn back to God in the soil of Israel's life. Elijah, don't stop here. I want you to go. You can't understand today. You don't know tomorrow, but just go. Will you go? You see, the discouraging, lonely experiences of life can create one of two kinds of people. It can produce dependency upon God or despair. It can produce awareness of what God is doing or great anxiety. It can produce compassion for the people of God or consternation that God isn't doing enough for the people of God. It can produce committed service, or it can lead you to a standstill. How do you take the proper steps to ensure that you arrive on the side of service and dependency? Let me quickly give you some. I was reading this book again. It's in my library. It's called Guidelines for Disciples, and I was reading for other purposes. And when I found this, I knew that this would be a good resource. Let me quickly give them to you. Since there is no sin in being lonely, I want you to get this. Don't add additional guilt to your problem. Elijah was never condemned for being lonely, for being discouraged. Second of all, don't depreciate yourself. If God has accepted you, He has, accept His valuation of you. The exciting thing to me is that God doesn't say to Elijah here, Elijah, I'm disappointed in you. You've sat under this juniper tree and now you're in this cave. I just want to show you that I'm in control. Now you just stay here and I'll take it from here. That's the mystery of the divine will, that He would choose to pick Elijah back up and brush him off and say, Elijah, I want you to go and continue representing me to your pagan world. 3, learn to live with some unsolved problems. I know these are all mouthfuls here, but it's true. In fact, Jesus told Peter, you don't understand what I'm doing right now, but you're going to later. Can you live with some unsolved problems? Not necessarily a fatalistic point of view that never seeks to pursue solutions, but just living with a sense that God won't give us solutions to everything. There are some things unsolved in life. 4, abandon self-pity. Saunders calls it that dismal fungus. He goes on to say, to be sorry for oneself perpetually is a one-way ticket to deeper loneliness. Focusing our thoughts on ourselves only fuels the fires of despair. 5, share your feelings, struggles, and failures with your understanding Lord. Tell Him how you feel. You may not understand, but you can count on the fact that He does. Last, if outward circumstances cannot be changed, inward attitudes should be. George MacDonald wrote, and he quotes him here, God will carry us in His arms till we are able to walk, and He will carry us in His arms when we cannot walk, but He will not carry us if we refuse to walk. I know that's hard, but it's the truth. And it can lead a person out from underneath a juniper tree into new, fresh service if it will be taken. You know what's interesting to me is that God never asks Elijah, do you feel better now? He never says, Elijah, I'd like you to change your mood. No, He says, Elijah, I want you to exercise your will. I want you to get up, and in the light of what I have taught you about myself and what you have learned about yourself, I want you to go. Verse 19 says it all. Look there. So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, while he was plowing with 12 pair of oxen before him. Ladies and gentlemen, as far as I am concerned, in this biography of Elijah that we have been studying, this has been the most severe test that he has had to deal with. This one right here. On the strength of God's word alone, Elijah has gone forward. His hopes have been dashed. His expectations have been lost to the wind. His plan and prayer for a national revival will never be seen by him. And however, on the basis of this book that says, go, Elijah, recording God's word, he gets up and he goes back into battle. James said, Elijah was a man just like us. Oh, would the word say, we are just like him.